Welcome to Worlds Apart. A few days ago, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary selected gaslighting as its word of the year for 2022, defining it as the act of practice of grossly misleading someone, especially for one's own advantage, and noting that the usage of this word increased by over 1700% throughout the year. Does geopolitics have anything to do with it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Adeyinka Makinde, visiting lecturer in law at the University of Westminster. Mr. Makinde, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for granting us this time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let me first of all ask you about this very curious phenomenon of gaslighting and its increased popularity, both as a word and I assume as a phenomenon in English-speaking countries. And I stress specifically English-speaking countries because, for example, in the Russian language, we don't have such a word or an idea. There is a concept of lie, there is a concept of truth, but nothing in between. What does it tell you about social relations, social changes, that this kind of phenomenon seems to be taking on such a prominence?
Well, I think it goes beyond geopolitics. I think it tends to be a modus operandi through which established governments have tended to operate. I can see this in regard to big events, things to do with the Iraq War, things to do with the clash of cultures, the so-called culture wars in America and in Britain, and also geopolitics. And quite specifically with this issue of Russia, although not exclusively to Russia. So in a sense, yes, I think it's very important that the West should listen to all viewpoints. They don't appear to. And I'm quite aware of what President Vladimir Putin mentioned about what he considered to be the empire of lies, which is an extraordinary response to the successor state of the Soviet Union, which was described as the empire of evil and the enemy of free speech.
Absolutely. And I think in that speech, President Putin meant that those lies are not just manufactured out of ill will. They are specifically conjured up to influence public opinion. And this is not actually a new phenomenon. Long before gaslighting, I think it was in the 19th century that the Prussian general and war theorist Karl von Clausewitz coined this term, the fog of war. But in his time, it meant this state of incomplete, dubious, erroneous information that led decision makers to make wrong calculations or take wrong decisions. Do you think we have come to the point in the 21st century when the fog of war doesn't just exist as as a natural reality, but is essentially manufactured deliberately?
I think there's no question about that. I mean, one can pick up quite a few notable examples just from this tragic war in Ukraine, where certain events were posited as having happened, but have had to be backtracked. You know, for instance, the issue of Snake Island, the so-called heroes or martyrs of Snake Island. What is particularly galling about this is that many in the West should be aware that these narratives have been exposed for being lies that they are, but yet they keep falling for them, and this is a very worrisome thing. It's something that's all may actually partake in war. Let's not forget the Russian military doctrine includes maskirovka, which is all about deception. But what is particularly noticeable is that these forms of deception either emanating from secret intelligence services or military intelligence services from the West are not checked. I mean, you mentioned Clausewitz. The very way in which the Russian Federation is prosecuting this intervention, you know, you find that they've been saying that Russia is losing the war. The Russian military is incompetent. And this is disturbing because you have military figures such as the former general David Petraeus. You also have General Wesley Clark. And they are talking heads, but they fail to recognize the Russian military doctrine of which is based in part or certainly analogous to that of the Clausewitz doctrine of maneuver warfare, which is not obsessed with acquiring territory, but is about annihilating an enemy. And so what I see is that even if you have a particular point to make, you should engage with the opposite view.
You mentioned that it's very difficult to sort through the various narratives, especially given that they are so polarized. I wonder, how do you personally see through all these gas and fog to arrive at your own analysis? Do you have any rules that you follow in order to arrive at your own opinion?
You need to be aware of all the different views, and you need to access those views. So it doesn't help if RT and other Russian outlets are banned, because, you know, I was growing up, I was a child during the Cold War. And quite frankly, you know, I would tune in, I love shortwave radio, I would tune into, Voice of Moscow, Radio Moscow, Albania, and, you know, I could see deception. I could actually see falsities there. There's no question about that. The problem is this disconnect that the Russia of today is the Soviet Union of the past. And so if the voice of Russia or the Soviet Union was so wrong, what is there to fear? Why would you need to ban those sources from Russia? I simply do not understand it, because you can then put it up to scrutiny and then ridicule it. So that tells me, and I think those who are thinking, those who come from an Athenian mode of thinking rather than a Jerusalemite theme of thinking, will be able to sort out the wheat from the chaff.
Well, let's try to think out loud together. I heard you say before that America's and to some extent NATO's policy is predicated in part on creating enemies, even when objective reality allows for peace and compromise. And I wonder, what do you think is driving this dynamic, and is it primarily economic or psychological?
Well, I mean, I think you can't speak about this unless you have a proper historical and contemporary context of the animus of the West, the United States-led NATO, towards Russia. And it's all, again, from the ending of the Cold War, that Russia, the quote-unquote, the victory of the Western ideology over the Soviet one, still necessitated that Russia should be subjugated. And so every form of foreign policy by the West has been geared towards subjugating Russia by a pronged attack that involves three things: a military aspect, an informational aspect, and definitely an economic aspect. And these have been continuous. And we can go through them. We can identify them. We can look at the issues on the military side of all the painstakingly built up nuclear safety treaties, things like the like SALT, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. All those treaties that followed seem to have been dismantled, and the dismantling has not come from the Russian side, it's come from the Western side.
Well, and this is actually an interesting question, because I think part of the rationale that drove that dismantlement is the belief among some decision makers, particularly in Europe, but I think also within the wider West, that war as a means of geopolitics is obsolete, at least on the European continent. And many of my progressive European friends are absolutely aghast by the fact that there are people who are fighting and dying in their thousands in the midst of the continent. But I wonder if this readiness to abandon war and to believe that war is no longer possible, no matter how you push Russia, he will not fight back with weapons. Don't you think that it's in part responsible for this conflict, this type of pacifistic thinking?
Well, I mean, the way I certainly understand it is that these pressures were designed to force Russia into a situation in which it would either voluntarily submit its sovereignty to the West, or it would lash out. And part of the strategy of the economic warfare against Russia, apart from the colonization that occurred during the time of Boris Yeltsin, was this idea of provocation, reaction. Russia's been essentially reactive. You just need to look at the evidence there. And after each reaction, there are sanctions imposed. So I think the idea there was that eventually Russia would be ground to a sort of subjugation.
I think there was a belief, and I think there's still a belief within some American circles, that war is such an unimaginable course of action, that it is so detrimental and that it's actually so horrible that Russia will have to swallow whatever is pushed its way without actually, you know, taking an initiative and fighting back.
Yes, I think obviously that is that is clearly not correct. And obviously the United States has instigated many wars, both overt and covert. You know, the destruction of Iraq, covert war in Syria, destruction of Libya. We've seen the occupation of Afghanistan. And, you know, in these situations, those are active wars. I think obviously where the disconnect is that the war is closer to home with European people. Albeit there is that subtext of the superiority of the Anglo-Saxon over the Slav, certainly when it comes to Russia, but it also rears its head in other instances. And so that idea about war being the ultimate evil, I think, is a correct way to approach human relations. Unfortunately, you're not going to be successful in achieving that if your doctrine is based on that of aggression and confrontation.
Mr. McKinley, we have to take a short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Adeyinka Makinde, visiting lecturer in law at the University of Westminster. Mr. Makinde, I know that you have a particular interest in the history of espionage and security studies, and it's such an interesting topic because intelligence services have always played a role in geopolitics, but over the last decade, I think it has turned into a full-blown spy war, especially in Syria, when you had one covert action against another. And there are also a proliferation of private armies, and many countries prefer to use covert means rather than overt ones. Why do you think covert operations are proliferating in this supposed age of transparency? And do you think the Ukrainian conflict will change any of that? Because I think what Russia did in launching this military operation, it's essentially calling a spade, and it's going out kinetically to defend its interests rather than relying on intelligence services.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole idea about covert wars is that you try not to reveal your hand. Your hand remains hidden. And I think they are obviously conscious despite the protestations, the idea that war is something of the past, the full-blown war is something of the past, the idea of using a proxy is more satisfactory. This is clearly the case in Ukraine, which is arguably a client state, which is being used to fight Russia. There's no question about that. And I think, hasn't there been a development of it? I mean, I think it's always existed. You know, there were proxy wars during the Cold War, a number of them situated on the African continent, in Angola and Ethiopia. So I wouldn't necessarily call it a phenomenon as such, because NATO revealed its hand in a sense, obviously in Iraq, which was a full-blown invasion by American forces and those who allied themselves with America. And also in Libya, you did see particularly the air forces, the use of missiles from the Mediterranean by NATO to guide this Islamist proxy army to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. So this use of proxies, particularly those involved with extremist policies, is not new. If you go back through the century, started with the British Empire, even the Germans were involved in that sort of warfare. But in modern times, and you can connect it with the Ukraine situation, in modern times, you find the Eisenhower administration using the Muslim Brotherhood to attack the secular government of Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. So the whole idea about covert war, I guess, yes, has been fine-tuned, and its privatization has been fine-tuned, which actually the Russians are involved in that form with the Wagner Group, who are increasing their presence in Africa. So, you know, it goes for both sides.
You mentioned NATO being involved in all this, in African conflict, in Libya, in Syria as well, indirectly, but it has always denied that its purpose, its sort of new times purpose, is to be aggressive towards Russia. Do you take this refusal to dismantle NATO after the Cold War as a case of, I don't know, institutional inertia and vested interest with bureaucrats and weapons manufacturers wanting to keep their paychecks or their profits coming? Or do you think it was in fact strategic at that point, that is, NATO continuing to sort of serving the exact purpose that it was created for, albeit in a plausible, with plausible deniability?
Well, first thing is the role of plausible deniability is easily overridden. Because you can point to position papers, you know, by the RAND Corporation, which talked about the long war in the Middle East, whereby the United States would use the Sunni-Shia conflict. And we can see that the evidence came out in the wars in Libya, in the wars in Syria. We also can see it in the use of those who profess an ultra-nationalist ideology in Ukraine. So these unholy alliances are there to see the position papers, the things that crop up in the press have cropped up. But as far as the Cold War is concerned, I think that was a moment lost in history where the security architecture in Europe could have been changed. And I think it was out of self-interest that NATO needed to be maintained because of the military industry, which President Eisenhower famously referred to as the military industrial complex. Out of self-interest, it needed to perpetuate itself. And part of the idea of the Wolfowitz doctrine, which emerged at that time, was to ensure that with the vacuum caused by the fall of the Soviet Union, that another power, another economic or military competitor would not be able to rise. Well, this is why we have the agitation against Russia and China today. But I would just say, look, that ultimately speaking, you cannot understand the conflict with Russia if you do not understand that there is a project to subjugate Russia, regardless of who is controlling in Russia, whether you term that person a democrat or an autocrat. There is a need to control the resources, the vast mineral resources of Russia.
Mr. McKinley, one thing that I cannot grasp, is how such an idea, and you wrote extensively that the some in the West want to see Russia simply as a geographic entity, not as a sovereign state, but as a geographical entity, which is solely dedicated to the service of energy needs of the West. And this is actually not a new idea. A couple of policy makers, American policymakers, are on the record stating that as the national interest or national goal. But one thing I cannot grasp is how such an idea could come into their minds. Because, I mean, you don't need to have a very deep knowledge of history to understand that a country the size of Russia, the sort of the natural national and cultural character of Russia will never succumb to something like that. Why do you think these people believe in, you know, in the possibility of something like this?
Well, that's the two things one must mention there. I mean, there is the aspect of American exceptionalism, which in its most positive form sees America as being this dynamic, this creative force in science, in culture, sciences. But there's that ugly aspect which puts America above the rest of the world.
Well, that's fine, but that doesn't mean that the rest of the world should cease to exist to serve that great American vision.
If you follow that ideology through, unfortunately, it is. It's an abrogation of the Enlightenment, the Enlightenment value, you know, encapsulated by Immanuel Kant, who spoke of his, you know, his categorical imperative that we are you deal with other people as humans, and you deal with people according to an ethical principle which is consistent and universal and will be applicable to you. But unfortunately, this is the reality. And also, you have to mention the neoconservative movement. The people who are involved in that ideology do not know what a backward step is. They will go on and on. They have already led America into successive disastrous wars. And unfortunately, this is what they, where people do not see the reality coming through. Unfortunately, they deludedly will persist. And I've also got to say something here. I think there's a really terrible development in terms of Europe not pushing back. Because if you go back to readers like De Gaulle, even Willy Brandt, who was an Atlanticist and believed in a united Europe, I mean, he still had room for Ostpolitik, which is something that could be continued to this day, along with the mentality of détente, which has been lost. But unfortunately, we see that European leaders appear to work as vassals. This was not the case, say, in the 1980s, when the first pipeline, you know, from Siberia to Western Europe was being built. When America started imposing sanctions on the Soviet Union, there was pushback by the European Union. You know, it said this is against free trade. And there was pushback by Margaret Thatcher. She said it was unfair that the nations would act this way. So this unreality, this unreal policy is unfortunately given back up by this, I would argue, the swingless conduct of European leaders in acting against their own interests.
We only have 2 minutes left, and I want to go back to that theme of spy games, as well as the particular relationship between Russia and the Great Britain, because we are often talking about the US-Russian rivalry, but I think the relationship between Russian and British intelligence services are very, very interesting. And not many people know that Vladimir Putin's first visit as Russian head of state was to Britain, specifically to try to normalize historically a very tenuous relationship between our countries. The relationship that is sure to become very, even more tenuous, given that the British security and military officers are very, very active in training Ukrainian military personnel these days. What do you think is at the bottom of this seemingly imperishable enmity?
Well, I mean, I wrote something a few years ago about Britain and Russia and this what I felt was a fruitless rivalry, you know. But Britain is essentially the second state within NATO. This goes back to its creation. So if you look at NATO, it's something that is dominated by the United States. But the Imperial Britain, which obviously declined and passed on its torch to America after the Second World War, has unfortunately found a comfort in playing this second fiddle. What you see in Ukraine today, that's what happened in yesteryears when it came to training these stay-behinds for NATO, which actually morphed into something a bit more sinister. So it is a big shame because trade is something that the focus should be on, not on espionage games, not on economic warfare, or you know, the sort of geopolitical confrontations that we've become used to.
And yet this confrontation continues. And if I may ask you very quickly, it's no secret that the Ukrainian side now relies very heavily on Western intelligence and satellite capability. Some Russian experts suggest that it's far more detrimental to the Russian forces than the Western supplied weapons. Doesn't that make Western countries nominal participants in that war? And do you think people in Britain or in the United States realize that their money are going directly to funding this war and fighting against the Russians?
Well, I think that given the fact that there is an energy crisis caused by the sanctions imposed on Russia, which blew back, I think people are getting wind of this, and there is a Ukraine fatigue setting in. It is a proxy. It is a proxy war, and again, this is where yes, the West needs to. The Western public needs to be educated about that. But it's also where we could see that there were faults from the Russian perspective in the way that they have conducted this war. If they had embarked on a shock and awe war. And stopped. Obviously, Vladimir Putin wanted to not have a situation where fellow Slavs were innocent civilians were murdered en masse in a sort of what you would say is collateral damage. But he's opted for this go slow police action, and that has only given the West the opportunity to widen the conflict. And that's I would stress. The idea about war is not something I would entertain, both from the Russian side and the Western side. This is an unnecessary war. They should have implemented the Minsk Accord. They should have accorded the rights to the Russian-speaking minority in eastern Ukraine. And we would have peace, with Ukraine being a neutral state, focusing on developing its potential as being one of the richest nations on earth.
Well, that would have been possible if, gaslighting as a phenomenon of geopolitics wasn't so popular, because none of that was discussed in its proper time openly on Western media. But at least we are thankful that we can have this conversation here on RT. And Mr. McIntyre, I'm really appreciative of your time today with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.